Word of mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. 145,000 businesses start up each year in the U.S. Many launch in garages, home offices, or in the case of Stonyfield Farm, a drafty old farmhouse on a New Hampshire hilltop with seven cows and a dream. Like most entrepreneurial ventures, the company also had vision, some capital, market research, and an understanding of expenses and competition and supply chains. How a new business will affect the personal life of its leader or the lives of their families and spouses, however, rarely figures into a business plan. Meg Cadu Hirschberg worked with and stood by her husband Gary as he built Stonyfield into the largest producer of organic yogurt in the world, with annual sales now at $370 million. In her career as a freelance nonfiction writer, her balancing acts column for Inc. magazine, her travels with her charismatic husband, and hundreds of interviews, Meg discovered tensions, taboos, real-life resentments, and some practical solutions for those building a business while also pursuing a fulfilling family life. Her book, For Better or For Work, is a survival guide for entrepreneurs and their families, and we welcome her to Word of Mouth. Thanks so much for being here, Meg.
Thanks, Virginia. It's great to be here.
So what did you tap into back in 2008? You wrote an article for Inc. about hitching yourself to someone else's dream. A lot of reaction.
Yeah, I actually wrote it as a lark, really. Some people had told me, friends of mine, you should really write about those early days at Stonyfield from a different perspective, not the entrepreneurs. And I did it and submitted it to Inc., and miraculously, they took the piece. And Inc., the magazine, and I were really surprised and affected by the profound reaction to the piece. Inc. got hundreds of letters from this piece. And about a month later, the editor-in-chief called me and said, I think you've tapped into something here, and how about doing a regular column? And I replied to her, I think I've said everything I care to say about this topic. And she said, I don't know, Meg, I think you have more to say. Well, it turned out she was right. And we launched my Balancing Acts column, which I've done now for 3 years.
Well, so you really struck a nerve, obviously. And a lot of it is about, the entrepreneurial spirit. We're told, in America, this is one of our proudest, most wonderful things, right? And the entrepreneur, they're often portrayed as being, a breed apart from the rest of us, right? They're energetic, they're risk takers, a high level of self-confidence. Is that Gary?
Oh, absolutely. And for this book, I interviewed hundreds of entrepreneurs, and I also do that for my column. And I would say, yes, they are a breed apart. And there's something very magnetic about entrepreneurs. It's not like, gee, I'd like to do this someday, but it's I'm going to do this and I'm going to do it now. And, there's a tremendous energy around it. And so it's very understandably a big part of the American dream for good reason. Mm. However, what I am bringing out here in my book and in my columns is that can have a very profound effect on the family as well. And that's not to say that therefore entrepreneurs should not found their businesses, but just that they should bear in mind that there are risks, personal risks that they're taking as well as financial. And if they're prepared for those risks and if their families are better prepared, then they can deal with them much better instead of being blindsided by them.
I wonder also in striking this nerve, I guess, probably a lot of people don't want to talk about this. I mean, it may feel disloyal to the entrepreneur, to the new business, to the chances of a new business to say, this is tough. This is hard on the family.
Yeah, exactly. And that's absolutely true because business is so personal. The entrepreneur is very much identified. It's their baby. It's almost like another member of the family. So if the spouse is put in a very difficult position, if I challenge how much my husband or my wife is spending or how much time they're spending on the business, then I'm challenging her or him, as the case may be. And so it does become very personal very quickly. And I think absolutely it becomes what they call a third rail in a marriage. People are afraid of touching it for fear that things will explode. But of course, as we all know, and we all intuitively know, that not talking about these things doesn't make them go away.
I remember the film Food, Inc. There are some very early grainy footage of the early days of Stonyfield Farm, which you called the bad old days, I think.
Yeah.
And in my mind, I don't know if it's true, everyone's sort of wearing overalls. The sun is always out, But it was very difficult for you. You lived there. Employees were in and out of the place. It was in transition. There was the smell of yogurt making all of the time. And I wonder now that the figure you write in the book, the last data from 2007, 18 million home-based businesses in the U.S. Probably,
at least.
Probably higher now that,
probably
you know,
more.
Since the economic downturn. You write that they are a big tease, home-based businesses. What do you mean by that?
Well, because they seem, at first it all seems like, gee, this is going to work out great for the family because the entrepreneur is going to be home. And let's say in the case of a man, if it's a man, he can help pick up the kids after school. And, you know, it sort of dangles dad in front of the spouse and family saying, gee, you know, he'll be more accessible. He'll be more available. But then at the same time, the business sort of yanks him away because business requires the entrepreneur to be all in. So even though they may be physically present in the home, they're not mentally there. And it's very confusing, especially to children, because they see their parent in the house and they think, oh, gee, I want to talk to, you know, mom or dad. Or in the case of the spouse, I've heard this more than once, the spouse will want to say, let's go out to lunch. Mm-hmm. You know, let's just take a little break. But the entrepreneur is in the zone. And even though they're physically present, they are not there mentally, and they don't want to take a break.
In fact, you write about some of the – you speak to people who have mastered the art of the death stare. You know, if they're talking to a client on the phone or something, you know, they say to their kid, do not come in here or make noise right now. Well, there have to be a lot of boundaries. And eventually, you, having worked on the books, I guess, and accounting, the business end of things, decided to just step away from that part of the business.
Yeah, I wrote a whole chapter about spouses working together, and I have interviewed people for whom it's been the best possible experience to build their dream together. I have also interviewed an equal, if not greater, number of people for whom it hasn't worked out. And there are a lot of reasons for that. That's why I devote a whole chapter to it. One of which is that, you know, behavior and responses in the workplace are very different than at home. In the workplace, you have to compartmentalize. You can't always explain decisions. You know, things can be abrupt. It's not like a nuanced environment, whereas the relationship between a couple, you know, needs to be nuanced. There needs to be discussion and understanding. So unless you're really good at compartmentalizing, which I am not, I would not recommend working with your spouse. And in fact, Gary and I tried to work together for a couple of years, but I just couldn't. Well, there was that. There was the communication piece, but also the fact that our business was doing so poorly for the first many years that we were on the farm. And so living with all the financial, you know, brinksmanship that was going on, plus the sort of tension in the workplace, I just said, you know, I really have to separate from all of this. And it wound up being a great decision for us personally.
And raising kids at the same time.
Exactly.
Right. Meg Kadu Hirschberg is contributing editor for Inc., and she's the wife of the Stonyfield co-founder and chair, Gary Hirschberg. And we're talking with her about her new book. It's called For Better or Work. It's a survival guide for entrepreneurs and their families. You can find much more in the book and her upcoming reading on Wednesday, April 11th at Red River Theaters in Concord. The event is sponsored by Gibson's Bookstore. Well, we know you had doubts about whether or not the business would fall apart at times. How about the marriage? Did you worry?
You know, people have asked me that when they read about how terrible our early years were. They
tough.
Say, why didn't you divorce him? And, you know, it never really dawned on me, you know, because you just like with a business and often with a marriage, you just kind of get up every day and try to get through the day sometime. I mean, there's years like that occasionally in a business and a marriage. And there's no question that the business put, you know, an inordinate stress on us personally. But we had children and we loved each other and we really wanted to just make it through. So I think that was, it didn't really occur to either of us that that would be an option for us. So.
Well, even after the bad old days, you know, that's not always the end of it. The business got extremely successful through a lot of good thinking, good planning, good luck. But that doesn't mean it's smooth sailing after that. In some ways, the entrepreneur is even more unavailable.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the great myths of entrepreneurship. Again, I sort of devote a chapter to that called If Not Now, When? Because oftentimes people, when they're involved in a business, they keep delaying the big life decisions, whether it's buying a house or having a child or taking a vacation. The entrepreneur thinks, well, we just have to get through this sprint. We just have to hire that salesperson or open that new branch or make it to break even or whatever the goal happens to be at the time. But as soon as you meet that goal, there's always the next one. So it really does never end. The business is like a, well, in the beginning, it can be like a critical care patient that's, you know, always needing attention. But later, even when it's stable, it's always crying out for time and attention for the entrepreneur.
And the entrepreneur is always on. In fact, you speak to several people about strategies that they've taken in their family life to get away from the, what do you call it, the Bond girl, the BlackBerry.
Yes, <that's laughs>
always
what,
there.
That's right. That's what I call Gary's formerly BlackBerry. Now he has an iPhone. But I call her Bond girl because, you know, she's always there. She's always present.
And available.
And available. And she's everything, you know, alarm, calendar keeper, memory, phone, email. As I say, she's too big to fire. And it's hard to establish rules around that. But I think it's really important. It is, of course, this is a ubiquitous problem. It's not limited to entrepreneurs. And much of what is in my book is not limited to entrepreneurs. These kinds of issues can arise for someone, a politician, or for someone who's running a nonprofit. Really, anyone who's living kind of a mission-driven life or who can't really separate their work from the rest of their life very easily, a lot of this applies to them. And that's very true also for our technological connectedness. It's really important to set some boundaries around them, even if it's just turning off the smartphone during dinner, for example. And I wouldn't say just turn it off. I'd say also put it away because it's actual physical presence on the, you know, by the bed or on the table or at the beach. It exerts a kind of a power, a magnetic power. Put the thing away because it really helps people, I think, interact more personally if it's not even in their line of vision.
I was surprised at Yvon Chouinard, I think his name is, the founder of Patagonia, a hugely successful business. He has a cell phone now. That's the only way he's acquiesced. I mean, that's a pretty severe kind of reaction. I mean, is that must be a very distinct lifestyle choice to say, this is how far I'm going to go. I mean, how many entrepreneurs are willing to draw those kind of boundaries?
Well, I cite Yvon in the book because he's the only one I found out of the hundreds.
But I think in the photograph he's trout fishing or something.
Yeah, exactly. But he has, you know, he's about 10 years older than me. He's probably in his mid-60s. He's, you know, of a different generation with a different kind of set of values. And he realized that he did not need to be wedded to his device in order to run this company. So what he does, you might ask how he actually functions. What he does is he's hired a really great administrative assistant, Mike, who I've actually dealt a lot with. And so you email Mike, and Mike will print out the emails that he considers, you know, really need response, and he'll read them to Yvon. And that's how Yvon conducts business, and it seems to be working for him. I wouldn't advise that necessarily for an entrepreneur. Most don't have the choice to actually do that. But I just thought it was an interesting example.
You have so many examples of, you know, the fall of fortunes and supply chains and changes in the way that business is being done, but some things that we are totally not in control of. In 2001, you were diagnosed with breast cancer. And just as you were finishing treatment, which was successful, I think, and Gary's twin brothers, Bill and Jim, were hospitalized with some complications from muscular dystrophy and both died in 2002. So you lost two brothers. Devastating. And this was at the same time he was going on with some big negotiations to sell Stonyfield to Group Danone, the French yogurt maker. I mean, how does a control freak deal with that kind of illness? Is it helpful to have somebody who's used to juggling business schedules and uncertainties on your side when you're ill like that?
Well, that, again, I devoted a whole chapter to this because obviously serious illness can strike anyone at any time. And so you have to, you know, an entrepreneur can't just take advantage of a Family and Medical Leave Act and sort of leave the business for a week or a month or 2 months. You know, they're responsible for their investors, they're responsible to their employees, and if they become seriously ill or a member of their family, then they're torn between two constituencies to whom they owe everything. And so this fear of losing everything is compounded by the fear of losing everything. So it becomes, you know, obviously a very, very difficult thing to negotiate. And the entrepreneurs who I interviewed chose different paths. Some actually were able to completely step out of their businesses to help their families or to get well themselves. And others really couldn't afford to do that. So they made other kinds of accommodations to, you know, but I think you're absolutely right that certainly when a person is used to dealing with crisis, and entrepreneurs almost by definition are, because business is always a series of problems that you have to solve, they become sort of calm in the face of that. I think I can generalize that way, that they learn not to freak out. And they become calm, and they gather the information that they need, and they're able to more coolly make decisions than some of the rest of us.
And it's been a terrifically successful business and a terrifically successful marriage. Like, weathering things like that, those kinds of difficulties, is what strengthens it. And I look at Gary, though. He's a guy that makes us all feel like we should do more, you know, with our own lives. And I mean, this book is really a love story in many ways. You do feature so many other couples, hundreds of people who you've spoken to through the years. But very much at the core of it, it's about the two of you. And I just wonder, you know, we all assume that this is what it takes to make a business happen, that you have to sacrifice, that things have to fall by the wayside. After writing this book, what do you think?
Well, I think a couple of things. First, I think there is a myth around entrepreneurship that, you know, somebody with a bold idea and a vision strikes out, you know, into the wilderness and creates, makes this dream come true, or tries to. And there is a lot of truth to that. But a big focus and point of my book really is that it's never a solo journey. You know, when that person strikes out, they're bringing a wagon train along with them of people who are very much affected by their decisions. Often an entrepreneur will take a line of credit out on the house or borrow money from friends and family who are also friends and family of the spouse, of course. And so it becomes very much a family venture. Everyone is affected by it. And so not to say that it's, you know, that that's a bad thing, because business being, and I can speak personally about this, that having a family business has been a tremendous experience for myself and for our children. They've learned a lot about business, about economic literacy. Their first jobs have been in our company. We travel a lot. We've met a lot of great people. We've made a lot of money. You know, we've financially, it worked out for us. So I don't mean to say that it's not worthwhile, but again, I would say you need to be prepared, because I did speak with a lot of people whose marriages went south or whose families broke apart because they didn't know how to deal with the issues that arise.
Well, Meg, I'm so glad it's worked out for you, and what a pleasure speaking with you today. Thank you.
Thanks, Virginia. It was fun.
Meg Kadu-Hirschberg. She is a freelance nonfiction writer, contributing editor for Inc., and author of the new book, For Better or For Work, a survival guide for entrepreneurs and their families. You can find more in the book and her upcoming reading. That's on Wednesday, April 11th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Red River Theaters in Concord. Now, the event is sponsored by Gibson's Bookstore, and will also convene some of the people she wrote about for the book and the panel. Details on the event, Meg, and the book are at wordofmouthradio.org, and you can also find links to follow us and share your thoughts at Word of Mouth Radio on Facebook or at Word of Mouth on Twitter.